You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eventually, everyone winds up eating alone, whether it's an act of rebellion, indulgence, or just a simple fact of life. It happened to Jenny Ferrari Adler when she moved from New York City to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And while meeting new friends, she took comfort in swapping stories about cooking just for herself. Ms. Ferrari Adler is now the editor of a new collection of essays called Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought her to our show today, along with Holly Hughes and Laura Dave, two of the book's contributors. Welcome.
Thanks for having us.
By the way, later we'll be taking some listener calls to find out what listeners feel about eating alone. But first, Jenny, when did you move to Ann Arbor?
I moved into 2004 in the autumn, and I went to graduate school out there.
Most people move to Ann Arbor to go to school.
Yes, it's a great college town. And I found myself living alone for the first time, and found myself dealing with cooking for myself, which was so, I found it really hard and strange. And I had loved to cook, and I had loved to cook for roommates and friends. And I was very confounded by the way I was cooking for myself. And so one of my first inclinations was just to try to find out, what do other people do? How do they deal with this?
Well, cooking for yourself means small portions. And either you cook larger portions and then you just save stuff, or you really don't want to do stuff that's too complicated, isn't it? Because
Right. It's
just for you.
Exactly. And I think, you know, even with when you shop, you sort of find yourself buying just one vegetable rather than you buy maybe 10 if you were cooking for someone else.
And then there's just this stuff like, do you have to sit at a table with a napkin? And
Right. Do
you have to set up a place setting for yourself?
Right.
You can do all of those things that your mother complained about, eating while you're standing or while you're standing over the carpet, if you wish.
Right, you can. And then it when you're doing it night after night, it becomes sort of a reflection. And you have to sort of think, what does this say about me and how I treat myself, or what am I really like when no one else is watching me?
So did this project grow out of that grad school writing program?
No, it was sort of a sideline to that. I mean, I was there and I was working on a novel, but it directly grew out of the experience of being alone with too much time on my hands, and I had time to cook and really no excuses.
What was it about Laura Colwin's essay, which is the source of the book's title, that inspired you?
Well, Laura Colwin is such a wonderful food writer and fiction writer, and I had been a fan of her stuff for a long time. And when I reread her piece, Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant, it immediately resonated with me. She talks about when she was young and living in Greenwich Village in an epically tiny, tiny apartment where she strains spaghetti into the bathtub and doesn't have a sink in the kitchen. And I read it, and it's a very honest piece talking about all the ways she made eggplant. And it made me feel better in the way that reading, I think, always can make a lonely person feel better, where you feel like you connect to someone else's experience.
Holly, you say in your essay that eating alone is a luxury.
Well, when you talk about simplifying food, I'm comparing what I can do for myself, which could be as complicated as I want, to cooking for kids, which means you have to be completely simple. No sauces, no two foods should touch. And, you know, hot dogs are really much more preferable to a fine, spicy sausage. So, you know, after night after night after night of cooking these simplified foods, you know, for children, on the off night when I suddenly can cook for myself, I can let go all these other impulses that I've been bottling up night after night.
To some degree, cooking is also a thing, a legacy from one generation to another. I'm sure you learned from your mother's cooking, and did you pass it on to your kids?
I actually, a couple of summers ago, made my children all learn how to cook two things. And our rule was that each of them was responsible for dinner every night. Because I wanted them to have that feeling that, you know, the stove was not some foreign place. Because my mother never taught my sister or me how to cook.
When was your first adult meal alone?
It was the night of Nixon's resignation.
And how old were you?
Oh, gee, that would tell too much. Well, but I was in college.
Oh, okay, because you revealed that you poured yourself a glass of wine, and that would, we
the
would
drinking
hope, mean
age
you
was
were
18
of age.
In a lot of states back then.
When you went to college, did your palate change?
Yes and no. Not certainly it didn't change from the food that was being served at college. But I was free to go out with friends for dinners to a lot of places that my parents wouldn't have gone to. And I was in a different part of the country, and there were different kinds of food available.
When you cook for yourself, you don't have to worry about the kids' complaint. Oh, no, Mom, not that fill-in-the-blank again, not chicken again, not
fish, ever.
You can eat whatever you want.
Yeah, and you can put a sauce on it, which is pretty nice. And you can put some more extra spices on it, and you do all sorts of things.
You can put mushrooms on your food.
Mushrooms, yes.
Laura, you say that you also savor cooking and eating alone. Why do you think so many people don't?
Well, I think especially in New York, or a city where there's sort of endless options for how to eat and eating on the run, and there isn't a high premium on nurturing yourself or nourishing yourself, because it takes work, and it makes you have to take a minute and think, what do I actually want to do tonight? Do I want to take the time to do this as opposed to eight other things I have to do?
But even people who go to takeout places don't like to eat alone. And we're seeing a lot more takeout, at least in areas where there are singles.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just a matter of not wanting to do the work. You also, I knew a woman once who told me she never went to a movie alone because then people would know that she couldn't get a date on Saturday night.
Right.
I love going to movies alone. But eating alone in a restaurant, I always feel like I need a book. And that's not it's not because I don't want to interact with people. It's because time to read is scarce, too. It's lovely to sit in a restaurant with a book.
Do you think it's different for women and men eating alone in a restaurant? There was a time when restaurants used to have signs in New York in the window saying, unescorted women not allowed.
Mm-hmm. I think it does seem like men and women feel differently about it, and that men tend to worry about it less. That's my sense. But I mean, when I've done dining alone, nothing has really happened to prove that women are treated differently in restaurants. So I'm not sure. I think it seems like it comes more at this point from the women. I mean, Colin Harrison has a great piece in the book where he talks about, you know, his love of eating lunch alone in New York and the great theater of people watching. And that seems to happen more with men than women.
Well, he's also married to a writer,
mm-hmm.
so maybe the two of them have to divvy up the writing the cooking responsibilities along with the writing responsibilities. Laura, your essay is called How to Cook in a New York Apartment. So what advice do you offer?
Well, New York apartment has specific challenges because the kitchens are, unless you're very lucky, very small.
Well, usually when you're single.
Yes, especially then. When I moved back to New York, I was sort of, for the first time, living alone and on my own. And my mom, speaking of when Holly was speaking of children, and was this great, Southern cook. And I really learned that cooking and caretaking were wrapped together. So it felt rebellious to take the time to cook for myself, and especially in such small, cramped quarters, to figure out a way to do that.
And when you have small, cramped quarters, you also have to really be careful about your grocery shopping.
Absolutely, because nothing keeps. You know, if you have a freezer that's mm-hmm. the size of a pencil case, then what are you gonna put in there?
So what did you do to make the experience more palatable?
Well, I live right near a farmer's market in the city, so
that's a lot. It makes it a lot easier.
It makes it a lot easier. So then you go, and then it feels necessary. Like, well, these vegetables are going to go bad anyway. I have to cook everything. I have to make it crazy and use everything today.
Don't you think some people consider cooking virtuous? People sometimes even get self-righteous about the fact that they do all their own cooking.
And that they use fresh ingredients, and that they, go to a butcher instead of just getting the supermarket meat. Yeah, I think there's a kind of a snobbery built in there.
Jenny, what issues do people face when they are eating alone in public? Can you describe your recent New York Magazine article?
Sure. That was funny. I went to 7 restaurants in 7 nights, and I went to some very intimidating places like the Waverly Inn and Spotted Pig and even La Grenouille.
You got into the Waverly Inn without any problem?
I did. Through a friend of a friend, I managed to get a reservation, which my opinion of myself went way up after that. And that was an intense experience, especially because it was 7 nights in a row. And like I said, nothing, I kept waiting for the moment where someone was going to give me a really hard time, or I was going to get hit on or asked what my problem was. And that actually didn't happen, which was maybe bad for the piece, but sort of a good learning experience for me.
Were some of them more comfortable to eat in alone than others?
Yes. The Spotted Pig was surprisingly comfortable because there was sort of a boisterous,
but it's kind of a boho warm feeling to it.
Yeah. So even though I had been intimidated to go there, that it was sort of like being at a party. Actually, the Waverly Inn, too. It was like intimidating, but you were sort of in the party, so it was all right. I found La Grenouille to be rough just because, I mean, that's a very fancy French restaurant, and people were there, I think, celebrating, you know, their 50th wedding anniversary or a very, very special occasion. And I started to feel a little bit like a ghost, just very removed. Like, why am I here observing these people who are in the moment and I'm just watching it? I didn't like that.
Well, does this mean that that was an experiment?
Yes.
Does this mean that you're going to avoid doing this sort of thing in the future, or does this make you feel a little less reluctant to do it in the future?
No, it made me feel less reluctant. It was great, actually, to see how fine it was and to really realize that I felt like all the self-consciousness was really coming from me and not, you know, not from other people. So I realized, you know, nobody, if you eat alone in a restaurant, nobody is giving it the amount of thought that you are.
You mentioned that people went to La Grenouille as a kind of an indulgence to celebrate. A listener named Karen from Long Island emailed us yesterday with a story about eating alone at the University Club in Chicago, where they were throwing a farewell to foie gras meal because the city was banning it. And she went as an indulgence, mm-hmm. even though she went alone.
Mm-hmm.
I think in some cities, especially, or I should say it this way, when you're away from your home city, the idea of eating alone is less scary. Mm-hmm. You know, if you travel a lot for work and you're in another city, like no one knows you anyway, you can sort of sit there. But the idea of doing it when it's close to you makes it sort of more, I don't know, something.
Well, in a way, it reminds you that, and some people are discomforted by this, mm-hmm. it reminds you that you're alone.
Right.
And when you're at home and you can turn on the television or listen to some of your favorite music while you eat alone, it's not the same. It doesn't make you feel as alone, don't you think? Because you're doing the things that make you, that are your comfort zone.
Yeah, you become very aware that you're on public display when you're in a restaurant anyway, which you are when you're with a whole party, but you know, you don't think about it as much. I think it was in This Side of Paradise, Fitzgerald has a little thing that he writes. They're sitting in cafes, and he knows how Americans in particular are very uncomfortable sitting in a cafe and wasting time. They don't know how to relax. They don't know what to do with their hands. And I think you really feel that when you're in, I feel when I'm alone in a restaurant, I don't know what to do with my hands, and so I'm tempted to eat faster because it gives me something to do with my hands.
On the other hand, eating alone allows people to act out their idiosyncrasies, doesn't it? The things that might make you feel uncomfortable about ordering or cooking if others are witnesses to it, you can do when you're alone because you're just doing what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. I think that is, I mean, a great example of the ways in which cooking for one can be a luxury, as Holly says, or really fun. I mean, if you use it as a way to cater to yourself, or Laura and I learned the other day that some people are smart enough to use it as a way to practice a dish that they want to make later for others, which I think is something I should do more of. That sounds smart.
But then there are also those people who just want to have an all-white food meal or something like that, and they'd be afraid to order that way and have somebody ask, what are you doing?
Scrambled eggs seems to me to be the perfect thing that you make when you suddenly realize you have that free night and you haven't gone out to the farmer's market. All you're dealing with is what you've got in the refrigerator. And if you served that to your family or to, you know, a guest, they'd be horrified. Scrambled eggs. But scrambled eggs are delicious.
Right. And that's
very comforting.
No worse than eating meat at breakfast.
Right.
And I mean, I think you get a lot of that. Mm-hmm. In the book, too, people are using it as a chance to make comforting meals for themselves, like Nora Ephron. I love that she, not only does she make mashed potatoes, but she says you have to eat them in bed and you have to put in as much butter as you want. And then, of course, Ann Patchett talks about all these saltine snacks that she makes all these different ways and how she sort of loves them. So that's when it can get fun, I think, if you just accept it.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we will invite listener calls on this matter. We're talking with Jenny Ferrari Adler, who is the editor of a book called Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant, Confessions of Cooking for One and Dining Alone. It is published by Riverhead. Also with us are Holly Hughes and Laura Dave, two of the contributors to the book. Our number, 212-433-9692. That's area code 212-433-WNYC. My guests are Jenny Ferrari Adler, editor of a new book called Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant, Confessions of Cooking for One and Dining Alone. Other contributors include Ann Patchett, Amanda Hesser, Ben Carlin, Marcella Hazan, Laurie Colwin. It's a pretty impressive list. All these people were willing to do this. Haruki Murakami, Colin Harrison, Mary Cantwell. You found an old essay by MFK Fisher, because I'm sure you didn't ask her to do something. Jonathan Ames. it's a really impressive list. And two of the people who are in the studio right now, Holly Hughes and Laura Dave. The book is about the pleasures and sometimes the discomforts of eating alone. And we asked our listeners to join in, and one listener named Pat from Brooklyn emailed us yesterday and said, I normally cook for a family of four, elaborate balanced meals and fresh ingredients, but on the rare occasion that I'm alone, I make a big bowl of white rice with sweet butter, salt, and pepper. It makes me happy. It's my favorite thing to eat by myself. And I suspect there are a lot of people out there who do that sort of thing. They would be embarrassed to make it for the family, but something I really like. Like you mentioned scrambled eggs or mashed potatoes. These are the personal indulgences. Our number is 212-433-9692. And let's take some calls. Felice from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to mention that in my family of seven kids, we fed them exactly what we eat our whole lifetimes, and we never had complaint about the sauces or the spices or anything. And I just think it's ridiculous that people cook separately for their children.
Well, you're lucky if you can get away with it. How many people have kids who are just willing to eat whatever you put in front of them? I mean, even I, who am something of an omnivore, well, my mother was not the best cook, but when she put liver that she had cooked to a fairly well, and okra, which you really didn't understand, in front of me, well, I didn't want to eat it. And then there are kids who don't eat fish, you said, Holly. There are kids who won't eat beef. There are kids who won't eat certain vegetables. They won't eat salad. What do you do then? I know this is taking us away from the eating alone. But since this woman brings it up,
I think
you
have to
Holly?
Be willing to let them go very hungry.
Really?
And
you're going to go to bed hungry tonight.
I have not seen tantrums. I've seen simply the most nutritious part of the meal pushed to the side of the plate and simply not eaten. And I grew up in a family in which my mother made these classic Midwestern, Betty Crocker style meals, and my sister refused to eat certain things. My sister, who is now a vegetarian, who has exercised her personal choice and her personal palate and made that decision and changed her life that way. And there were knockdown, drag out battles. You know, her sitting at the table for 4 hours while the spinach that she refused to eat got cold. And I think having grown up with that,
and now she's a vegetarian.
Yeah, some people are super tasters and have a tongue that simply registers certain tastes so extremely, both for the good and for the bad, that you can't expect them to eat everything. And I happen to have one of those kids who's exquisitely sensitive.
Then there's the other side. You're a vegetarian and your kid wants to go to McDonald's. A lot of people go to fast food places when they eat alone because it's easy. I suspect a lot of people who eat alone don't eat nutritious meals because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's take another call. Lynn from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I actually cook for myself every night during the week, and I cook for someone on the weekends. And I have the good fortune of having a beautiful eat-in kitchen with granite countertops that I'm very proud of. So you treat yourself well. I treat myself well, but... And on that topic, what I wanted to say was what I do is I make sure that the food looks beautiful on the plate, even just for myself, because it's such a pleasure.
Well, you are, I think that's commendable. Most people would just slop it down. You know, who cares? Nobody's looking.
On the plate, and I think it's part of treating yourself well, and I think that's what cooking for yourself should be about.
What about when you go out to eat? Do you treat yourself well?
I actually don't go out to eat too much. I can, but it's such a pleasure, I think, just to cook for myself. It's time alone. It's something that I enjoy so much. I enjoy it more than eating out.
And how complicated are the dishes you make for yourself?
I make a lot of pastas. I make a lot of fish. Last night, I actually made my grandmother's cauliflower cakes. I made about 100 of them, so it was for more than just one person. But I do try to do a lot of my mother's recipes and my grandmother's, so lots of Italian food.
Thanks for calling us.
Thanks.
Martin from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hi. Just going back to the dining out and restaurants alone, one thing to consider is that some restaurant people do feel that it's a little bit of a waste to give a table up to a single diner in terms of the check average being just substantially lower.
Because they'd get a double tip if they had mm-hmm. two at that table.
In a restaurant where a table is a real commodity in a really busy place, like she mentioned the Waverly Inn, I haven't been there, but I would imagine, you know, it must be pretty hard to get a table there. And so a lot of times I think some restaurant management, maitre d's, owners might feel like it's kind of a waste of a table and would ideally like single diners to dine at the bar.
Have you worked as a waiter?
I've worked in all of the facets in the front of the house.
And what happens when you wound up with one person at a table?
Tend to try to steer them towards the bar if you can, but you know, you're not going to fight somebody on it. You don't want to offend anybody. You can't really make a rule about it.
Mm-hmm. I had that. I mean, I did have people suggest I go to the bar, and New York Magazine had told me, like, you have to get a table, so I would say, no, I need a table. And then I did often compulsively sort of order expensive things and order many courses. I mean, it was for
compensate.
A magazine piece, but, yeah, to be, like, assert very early on, like, to sort of let them know, like, oh, don't worry, I'm going to get that. I mean, I ordered a lot of food.
Well, it doesn't look like you put on any pounds, so I guess it all turned out okay. Thank you for calling us, Martin. Jay from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey. Actually, I was going to make the I have a couple of comments to make. One is that I eat out a lot, and frankly, I think sitting at the bar in a decent restaurant is a really terrific way to eat out alone because you almost always end up chatting with people next to you if you're an outgoing person, and you can actually, I've spent whole afternoons meeting people and chatting and having a nice glass of wine, so I think sitting at the bar is a great way to eat alone. My second comment was that one of the most fun things you can do in dining in New York alone, and it's also the best food value, is going to the James Beard House, and you don't have to be a member to go there. And that whole meal is a family-style thing, so even if you go alone, you're going to be sitting at a table with a whole bunch of other people, and you all have a common interest in good food, and it's actually a fantastic food value because you get an hour reception beforehand where they feature some kind of alcohol with hors d'oeuvres, and then you get a five-course tasting meal with a different wine paired with every course. So it's really terrific. It's about $120.
Now, the thing is that we can eat family style in less fancy restaurants, but he's suggesting that if you want really fancy food from some top chef, the James Beard House, I can't think of any other place where that could happen other than to sit alone. But the problem with that is that sometimes you are seated with people whose politics are totally opposite to yours and who insist on telling you everything that they have come to realize over the course of their lives, and you could really feel oppressed during a very nice meal. So it's important, if you're not going to eat alone, to eat with people you actually want to eat with.
Right. Jenny and I were actually talking about this just the other day, which is that you're not guaranteed a good meal if you're sitting with someone else or if you're sitting with a group of people. You might not be focused on the food at all. And so in that way, even a really lovely meal could end up being like, I really want to get off this table or away from here. Or when you see a couple or you see people sitting in a restaurant, this is something that, and they're not talking, and you want to go over there and like make them say something, and they're probably fine. But I'm always interested in when they start talking. People have very different dining rituals, and sometimes they talk after the food is gone. I'm like, oh, they're talking to each other. It's okay. But, you know, so it's always tricky.
And you always feel that you have to talk to the person to your right for a little while.
Exactly.
And then the person to your left for a little while, even though the person to your right is really interesting and the person to your left is a total dud. Even worse if they're both total duds. My guests are Jenny Ferrari Adler, editor of the essay collection Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant, and also here are contributing editors Holly Hughes, who is also the editor of the annual Best Food Writing Anthology, and Laura Dave, author of London is the Best City in America. This is WNYC in New York, which is really the best city in America. I'm Leonard Lopate, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Carol from Glenhead. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I love to cook. I always have. And now that my children are grown and my husband died, I still love to cook. And every day around 5 in the afternoon, I guess it's something psychological. I've got to go in the kitchen and start cooking. And if I don't, it gets to be around 6 or after. I really am in a state. So I go in and I always cook myself a full meal with potato and a vegetable or rice and salad and meat or fish, and I even make dessert.
But Carol, I get the feeling that you enjoy cooking, and there are many people who see cooking as a wonderful experience, even a chance, almost a meditative experience, and others see it and they love the chopping and everything.
Yes.
And then there are others who just see this as a lot of work for something that gets gulped down in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I guess you're one of those people who doesn't see it that way.
No, I love to cook, and I love to watch the food shows now, and I get some new ideas.
Great.
I also have grandchildren and my own children who always ate liver, fish. My little granddaughter at age 2 years old, her first taste of brie cheese on a cracker, looked up after finishing it and said, "More brie, please." Mm.
Well, that's terrific. It really is. Do you think that they should have cooking shows on television for Cooking for One?
I think that's a great idea. I think it should be called Alone in the Kitchen. No. I don't get the Food Network. I wonder. I might be like very addicted to it if I got it. But as is, I'm just sort of a food writing junkie.
Well, you don't get it because you don't receive it on your
set? I don't receive
it. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I find it. It has kind of slid a little bit into shortcut cooking and, you know, chirpy hosts without really teaching technique. I mean, I love to learn more and more about how to do certain kinds of cooking, and they used to have much more instruction on the shows than they do now.
Well, perhaps the success of not just the person you're talking about, but also all of these cooking competition shows, and we're seeing more and more of that these days. It's less about the food, which comes in, it always looks kind of odd and slightly over fancy, but it has more to do with which one is going to finally get the vote as the super chef, the iron chef, or the top chef.
I think there's been so much exposure to these, you know, celebrity chefs, people who don't even go out to the sort of restaurant where this sort of food is served, thinks that's good cooking. Mm-hmm. Sometimes good cooking is just getting a nice cut of meat and roasting it for the right amount of time, you know, just getting it spot, you know, a simple thing can be more indicative of your skill as a cook than whether you turn out some beautifully presented little thing with a lot of, you know, foam on it.
Jenny, did you speak to any chefs? Because my experience with chefs when they cook for themselves or when they cook for their families is they cook rather simple food. Better than anybody else, but simple food.
Well, there's the great story that Marcella Hazan tells in this piece, and she is sort of this preeminent Italian cookbook author and chef, and she says that she hates to cook for herself, and if she has to, you know, makes sort of a very simple ham and cheese sandwich or eats preserved seafood. So that was really, really interesting for me to learn that even someone who's made their living doing this finds it difficult by themselves.
Yeah, I worked in several restaurants for 1 or 2 days at a time because I was terrible at it. But I would always ask the chefs what they'd cook for themselves. And one chef said all he makes in his off time is Fruit Loops. and that's all he eats for all of his meals. And someone else said all she eats is mashed potatoes, like Nora Ephron. But really, no one makes anything if they're cooking all day, it seems like, for other people.
Mm-hmm. Well, they rarely eat their own food.
Right.
Maggie from Brooklyn. Hi, you get the last word.
Hi, how are you?
We're well. And you? You're doing good?
Yeah. I was calling because I used to work at a restaurant, and there was a woman who'd come in every day for lunch, and she would come in and she would eat alone, and she would insist that I push the table against the wall, and then she would face the wall, and she would order a lot of food, and eat all the food, and then she would come in for dinner with her husband, and she would eat just kind of like a normal meal.
Perfect.
That's great.
Well, so she really, she saw this as a chance to indulge herself, but she didn't want anybody to see.
Yeah, she trusted you.
Yeah, well, I mean, perhaps she trusted me, but also there was a lot of shame, and I thought this was a really interesting conversation just because of the shame involved that I would see every day.
What about you? Have you had experiences along these lines?
Have I eaten alone?
Yes.
At restaurants? Yeah, I eat alone at restaurants. I feel very comfortable doing that. I think especially someone who works in the food business feels more comfortable eating alone at restaurants.
Well, we thank you so much for your call, and we pretty much run out of time, unfortunately. I want to thank my guests, Holly Hughes, editor of the annual Best Food Writing Anthology. Who publishes that?
That's published by Avalon Books, which is now part of the Perseus Books.
As all publishing companies are becoming parts of other publishing companies. Laura Dave, author of London is the Best City in America. You really believe that?
No. I like New York.
Do you know that we are about to, in fact, a week from today, we are going to be involved in an international radio show in which London is challenging New York, Toronto, and Sydney, Australia, on which is the most diverse city. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to win. Mm-hmm. And when you think about all the restaurants we have here, we almost prove that case, don't we? You can't get decent Chinese food in London, but you can get pretty great Chinese food in New York, can't you?
You used not to be able to get good Indian food here, though. Now you can. But I would always go to London to eat Indian food because I love it.
Well, there's always a trade-off, although there are places in Queens that serve some pretty good Indian food,
mm-hmm,
too.
Now.
I want to thank you. Okay, Laura Dave, London is the Best City in America, and Jenny Ferrari Adler, editor of the essay collection that we've been talking about, Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant, Confessions of Cooking for One and Dining Alone, published by Riverhead, and with contributors who are some of the best writers in America on food and everything else. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.